Welcome to Focus. I'm Paul Nelson. Again today, we turn to art, and specifically to the literary arts, to get a sense of how things work at a root level. Many people still can't understand how art is used for youth crime prevention and positive youth development. Yet, after the Watts riots of 1965, poet Wanda Coleman did discover art as a way to channel the rage she felt as an African American in America. Writing had other benefits for her as well.
I felt that I was a part of a community that wasn't being documented historically, that events and things were occurring on a level that no one seemed to recognize, or if they did want to recognize, certainly didn't want to publicize.
Wanda Coleman has published many books of poetry, a novel, and was awarded the prestigious Lenore Marshall Poetry Award in 1999 for her book Bath, Water, Wine. Pretty good for a former welfare mother. The visiting poet for Fall 2000 at the Northwest Spoken Word Lab in Auburn, Washington, Wanda returns on Super Bowl Sunday, February 3rd, for the 5th annual Super Bowl of Poetry. You get a preview today as we hear from the very intense Wanda Coleman today on Focus. Our interview begins in just a moment. Thanks for tuning in. This program is made possible by Elaine Childs Gowell, author of Good Grief Rituals, Tools and Rituals for Healing Grief and Change, and Regression and Protection, a handbook for therapists and clients who are doing regressive work in touch. Information on the web at goodgriefrituals.com or at 206-781-0839. And by The Comfort Inn, 10 miles south of SeaTac Airport in Auburn, Washington, with in-room refrigerators and microwaves, an indoor heated pool, and business meeting space. For reservations, call Comfort Inn at 253-333-8888. Our Fall 2000 Visiting Poet Series now comes to a close, as it's our custom to document the visit with an interview for this program. Our fall visiting poet this year has been Wanda Coleman, an amazingly energetic, talented, and compassionate person and writer. Wanda is the author of many books of poetry, including her latest, Bath, Water, Wine, published by Black Sparrow Press. Winner of the 1999 Lenore Marshall Poetry Award, author of the novel Mambo, Hips, and Make-Believe, Wanda has worked as a medical secretary, magazine editor, journalist, and scriptwriter. She's our guest today as we discuss the transformation poetry has facilitated in her life and other things that we think may be of interest to you. Wanda, it's been an honor to present you to our audience this weekend. It's just been an amazingly magical weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Paul, for having me. It's been quite a lot of fun and really illuminating. The things that are going on here in Seattle reflect a rising interest in the literary culture across the United States.
Wait till we get funding.
Then you'll really be on a roll.
Well, we'll talk about that definitely. But and maybe when we get off the air, maybe on the air even, you can elaborate on the illuminating things that you found here this weekend. But what I'd like to start with is to get a sense of your entry into poetry. And your bio states that following the Watts Rebellion in your native section of Los Angeles in 1965, you joined the effort to turn the riotous energies of that incident into constructive modes. Now, why don't you tell us about that event and how it facilitated your entry into poetry, and more importantly, your ability to turn the negative into a positive?
Well, at that point in time, I was married. I had just started my family. I had two children, and living with my first husband, and our lives were very difficult economically and socially. I was in a mixed marriage in a city that wasn't too kind to crossing racial lines. And so we had a pretty tough time. And when Watts exploded, that was the first time in the history of the nation that blacks really took the liberty to be publicly vocal about how we really felt about our history, our lack of history, and how he had been treated. And in Watts at that time, a number of workshops and cultural centers sprang up in that part of South Central Los Angeles. And so there was a lot going on. There was a lot of interest. There was a great deal of media attention. And I was at the heart of that. I was attending Studio Watts. Another alumna of Studio Watts is Jane Cortez out of New York, who you might recognize her name. So the poet, Jane Cortez, had a drama and acting workshop at the time. The artist Sonny Bustian came out of Studio Watts workshop. So we're kind of some of the survivors of the success stories of that particular community venue. But there were others. There was Mafundi Institute. There was the Watts Writers Workshop, which was notoriously associated with Bud Schulberg, who had come out of New York into Los Angeles to build something, erect something positive out of the ashes there. So there were all these things going on. At the time, there were coffee houses and a lot of cultural fulmination. And as the sole writer at Studio Watts, I found that I was encouraged to develop my gift. You know, that there actually, I had never heard of grantsmanship, for example. That's where I first discovered that that whole world exists. You know, I knew nothing about the literary world. And the first time I saw Amiri Baraka's work, I was actually presented with his manuscript, a manuscript of a book that was about to be published. And I was given the manuscript to say, you know, to show what the potential was for me as a poet. And I was allowed to take the manuscript, you know, home and look at it and read it and study it and bring it back on my honor, which I did. I was able to get a scholarship. Writers, they had the famous writer's school at that time. I received the first scholarship from the famous writer's school and was able to take formal lessons to give me some of the craft underpinnings that I needed to really develop as a poet. So that began, and I was treated with respect. My gift wasn't dismissed. At that time, the school system in Los Angeles was very repressive and very dismissive of gifted young blacks. Here was an arena where we were being nourished. And this was some of the first nourishment I received. So that helped me start to look at those negatives and turn them into positives.
We have turned away from that. I'm guessing that this is some great society money that went into these programs. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. These were residuals of JFK administration cultural programs. The NEA hadn't or was about to come into existence around that time, the NEA and the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities. So these were monies that were feeding the culture, and I was one of the I'm a byproduct of that kind of energy, really.
Well, that was a very good investment, I think. We can get into that. When I read in your bio about the Watts incident, It doesn't call it a riot as the media folks and those writers of history would have you believe it was. A riot, but you call it a rebellion. There's a significant difference, and of course we see already in the language very important distinctions.
Well, I'm being terribly politically correct then. That was a part of the trend, even after what happened in the Rodney King beating case, for example. People were very careful in with their choice of words to describe it because the media was so unkind. I mean, it was quite something to turn on the news and have people calling thug, thug, thug. And you heard this word repeatedly referring to those who were in the streets constantly as thugs. And from my point of view, I saw full-grown adults. I saw mothers carrying diapers, you know, that they could not afford to pay for. So in terms of the kinds of people, and many, many Latinos and young white males were in the streets, but these individuals were not given any attention by the media, which focused, you know, it was sort of a black-white affair. which reflected the national discourse more than it did what was actually going on in Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, the dialogue and the tensions were taking place across a much more diverse landscape, which included a Korean community, an Armenian community, you know, an Arabic community. So there were a lot more factions involved in the total discourse at that time.
We're chatting with writer Wanda Coleman. She's the author of many books of poetry, including Bathwater Wine on Black Sparrow Press and the novel Mambo Hips and Make Believe. I'm Paul Nelson. Well, there's a couple of different ways we can talk about your experience as a writer. First of all, there's the writing that's accessible to everybody who can read and write, and that is writing as a feedback system. Writing is a sense, you know, if you go into the woods without a compass and a map, well, even if you have one, you can still get lost. but if you don't have some kind of feedback system, you're really SOL. And in life, we tend to go through it without a feedback system. Most of us don't journal. Most of us don't have some way to recognize, hey, wait a minute, I was doing the same thing a year ago, 6 months ago, 2 years ago. When we journal, we can look back and see what struggles we faced and how we can surmount them. So why don't you tell us about your experience using writing as a way to enhance your individuation?
Well, one of the things that I've decided that my writing has value, and I felt that I was a part of a community that wasn't being documented historically, that events and things were occurring on a level that no one seemed to recognize, or if they did want to recognize, certainly didn't want to publicize. So I was interested in making a record of that, so to speak, and I chose poetry and short fiction so far as my media in which to do that. I wanted to tell the stories. You know, that the word, the popular word is griot in the African American community.
G-R-I-O-T.
That's correct. And I wanted to perform that function to become a medium for those who couldn't speak, with whom I shared a common landscape and experience. And Los Angeles is so different as an urban landscape. It's much more different than the usual city that you find in the United States. There's no tradition. The terrain is extremely fluid, especially the cultural terrain. There's no way to nail it down. There's no way to corner the market effectively in Los Angeles. And so in the last 30 years, a very diverse and interesting group of literati have grown up there, and I'm among them. And so coming from the black side of town, from across the tracks, so to speak, from Watts, I have been interested in keeping those stories in the forefront of the dialogue. And I do that through my performance and poetry, through publishing my work, through insisting that there is another way of looking at these matters, these issues.
Well, they shot Lorca. They find a way to shut these people up. We make it so difficult for artists to live in the society that many of them just give up and don't bother doing it. The modernists, at this point in time, are winning, and they're preventing, by and large, quite often preventing people like you from telling the story and telling it with the kind of force that liberates other people and that creates positive change that almost happened in the 60s and that has to happen in this millennium or else we'll blow up the planet.
Well, it is difficult. Your books don't get reviewed. That's one way of keeping you quiet. They don't, even in the publications that are ostensibly liberal, so to speak, no book reviews. You don't get the invitations to present in certain venues. You're not necessarily on the lecture circuit. Those are the ways in which one can be silenced, so to speak. But I've just persisted, feeling that, and I think my receiving the Lenore Marshall Prize was a large part a vindication for me personally. It was an indication that my work was being appreciated. And above all, regardless of what my personal, you know, what issues I may consider important, the ultimate thing is the quality of the work. Is the writing crackerjack? Is it excellent writing? That's what I'm constantly striving for, everything else aside, because all those other things are material. And that changes over time. It comes and goes. But quality is consistent if you can maintain it.
So the notion here is that you're writing for people as much today as you are for people 200 years from now.
Oh, absolutely. If my work has merit in terms of quality, it'll be there. It'll survive me. And that's what I'm hoping for.
Yet 200 years from now, being famous or being still read in libraries or whatever the form is going to be 200 years from now, that doesn't put food on the table.
No, it's a presumption. I mean, there are no guarantees. One doesn't know. Increasingly, as the world becomes much more volatile, when we have the digital nation here now, paper disappearing, life seems even more temporary than ever before. So there's no guarantee of permanence, and one would like to get one's due while one's here. But you have a lot of great competition out there. There are so many fine writers that our MFA programs have produced now.
We'll talk more about some of those fine writers and some of the ones who have influenced you. What I'd like to talk about is some of your experience in trying to make a living, because as we've talked about, we live in a society that does not recognize the social capital that the arts help strengthen and facilitate. And you've had to do a number of things to make ends meet. We talked about journalism, being a medical secretary, I think one of the more interesting ones was writing a script writer for a soap opera for which you won a Daytime Emmy.
Days of Our Lives, as the hands drip through the hourglass. Yes, I wrote for Days. That was a real adventure. It was very exciting, for the year or so that it lasted, and I was the youngest member of the staff, and I had it was quite an experience, because writing for television is merciless when it comes to deadline. It knows no mercy. It eats writers. It eats everything you have to give. And so it was difficult in one way, because my portrait was subsumed. I mean, it was just gone. And I frankly was worried about that and depressed about it, because I didn't know, you know, what's going on here. But what I found is that after, you know, my style of writing, you know, before working for the soap opera, I was still writing on the legal tablets and the secretarial pads and writing things out in longhand and, you know, taking, you know, 10, you know, 15 drafts and still not getting it right. But after that stint as a soap opera writer, I could crank. The poems, when the poetry came back, when it returned, I mean, it just returned with a vengeance. And I found that I could sit down and those poems would just start coming. They would just flow. It was almost as though they were writing me instead of me writing them. And so that was, and I said, wow, look at this. So when my peers look at my books, you know, when I go to poetry book fairs and there are these very fine, thin, lovely books of poetry, and then, my volumes are considerably, you know, 300 pages, you know, fat books of poetry. And people say, how do you do this? You know, why are you so prolific? Well, that's a part of it. That experience freed me from whatever there was in my psyche that made me hesitate or take so long to finish the work. I was able to, at that point, see, you know, I had just become a better worker, a better craftswoman.
But when your collected poetry book comes out, it's going to break backs.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a world where books are getting thinner and thinner, you know, the novel is now down, what is it, down to almost 75 pages, and it's still called a novel. Yes, my collected works would break a back. I've published more work than Langston Hughes, over 900 pages of poetry, and it would if it were collected. So I'll have to just select it, be selective, and have a slimmer volume.
All right. Well, talking about your poetry is one thing, but hearing it is quite another. So do you have something you'd like to read for us?
Sure. Why don't I start with one of the sonnets? I had an idea for 100 sonnets, and every now and then, sometimes you want to play with the traditional, and you want to maybe do something new with the traditional. So the idea came to me of jazz sonnets, and I couldn't tell you what a jazz sonnet was at the time I had the idea. And I applied for some grants, the NEA and whatnot, which I did not receive, to do these sonnets. And then I just abandoned the idea. 10 years later, the first one showed up, and I recognized that, and I call them American Sonnets, and this is number 12, after Robert Duncan. My earliest dreams linger, wronged spirits who will not rest. Dusky crows astride the sweetbriar seek to fly the orchard sky. Is this the world I loved? Groves of perfect oranges and streets of stars where the sad eyes of my youth wander the atomic age paradise? Tasting the blood of a stark and wounded puberty? Oh, what years ago, what rapture lost in white heat of skin, walls that patina my heart's despair? What fear disturbs my quiet nights grazing, stampedes my soul? Oh, memory, I sweat the eternal weight of grave.
Now, that is absolutely intense. That was the first one that I pulled out of the book. The fact that it was dedicated to Robert Duncan is an important part of it. But just the ending, why don't you elaborate on that ending, if you will?
Well, I think in that last sentence, it capsulizes what I believe my job is as a poet. Almost as though I were in the process of storytelling, resurrecting by being the best craft person I can be, then I can honor those memories of those I treasure, whether it's a friend, whether it's a community, or my vision of a community, what I see, how I define, as my place, which is Los Angeles, defines me, I in turn define it. And I want to be as true to this process as possible. So I'm obligated, I feel, to do my best. So when I say I sweat the eternal weight of graves, I am embracing the responsibility that attends that process.
Or as the natives have said, we are the point people for our ancestors. We are responsible for cleaning up what is left over from the last seven and preparing the ground for the next seven generations.
Right.
Wanda Coleman is our guest, author of many books of poetry, including Bath, Water, Wine on Black Sparrow Press. We'll have more in a moment if you're listening to the hour version of this program.